Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, dancers, writers, musicians, athletes, comics, you name it. Folks who are center stage, backstage, on camera, or behind the scenes. Sit back and listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome back to the Rising from the Ashes edition of Foul Players Radio. My name is Michael Spedden. Please welcome to Foul Players Radio, actor and fellow Marylander, Cumberland, Maryland's favorite son, Eddie Deason. I spoke with Eddie, who's feeling much better now, by the way. He's had a heck of a year, and we're glad to see that he's back to his old self, about his long and storied career in entertainment. He left his home in Cumberland in 1975, the day after he graduated high school, to seek his fame and fortune in Los Angeles. The rest, they say, is history. He shared some great stories about getting gonged by Paul Williams on The Gong Show, performing stand-up comedy at the Comedy Store. His co-stars in Grease, such as Jeff Conway, John Travolta, Barry Pearl, and Sid Caesar, working on Midnight Madness with Michael J. Fox, Stephen Furst, and so many great character actors such as Irene Tedrow, Paul Rubens, Marvin Kaplan, and John Fiedler, throwing up in Steven Spielberg's trailer on the set of 1941, having ice cream with John Candy after shooting had wrapped, John Belushi, and so much more. He had a million great stories, and he's also genuinely a very good guy. Subscribe for free at www.foulplayersradio.com or listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, Overcast, Castro, Castbox, or Podfriend. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Foul Players of Perryville are now booking murder mystery shows for the late summer and fall of 2021. Indoor or outdoor venues, trains, boats, office parties, fundraisers, or just for the heck of it. 443-600-0446 or see us on the web at www.foulplayersofperryville.com. You can also email us at foulplayersperryville@yahoo.com. We'll be back with Eddie Deason right after these words.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Chris Rastali of Breaking the Fourth Wall. If you enjoy our show, you can find it on YouTube. Just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment, or just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment on Anchor.fm, Apple iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, or wherever quality podcasts can be heard. And also, you can find us on all the social medias. Just look for Realm of the Mist Entertainment, and I will catch you on the other side.
I'm Michael, the host of the semi-monthly podcast In a City Like Yours. Join me as I chat with interesting people with interesting life stories. You can listen to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can follow us on Twitter at IACLYS Podcast, as well as on Facebook and Instagram at In a City Like Yours Podcast. Please feel free to let me know what you think and keep coming back for the many interesting stories in a city like yours.
Hey, this is Don Smith from the Life Radio Show. If you've always wanted to learn more about the world of low-budget filmmaking and even lower-budget comedy, tune into the Life Radio Show. You can live stream the show at WWSU1069.org on Tuesdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, or find us wherever you find podcasts and like and follow the Life Radio Show on Facebook for live video and other shenanigans.
Hey, what's up? This is Chris Rastali of Realm of the Mist Entertainment. The podcast you are listening to is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com That's s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and information on those shows, as well as information and an ability to contact publicist Steve Joyner for more information. Just go to the website and check out the family. Ladies and gentlemen, until then, enjoy the show.
So, Eddie Deason, it's a pleasure to have you on Foul Players Radio tonight. I'm a fellow Marylander and one of my favorite people in show business over all the years. So, welcome, Eddie. It's good to have you.
My pleasure. It's my pleasure. What part of Maryland are you from, Mike?
I live in Perryville right now. I originally was, I was born and raised around Baltimore, and I lived there for about 40 years, and now I'm in Perryville. Basically, the complete opposite of where you're from. We're in absolute opposite corners of the state.
I see. Yeah, so, we're western, you're eastern?
Yes. Yeah, I'm right near the Delaware line in the upper corner. I'm not far from Philly. So
I see.
So it's a pleasure to meet you and everything and really get a chance to talk to you at length. You know, we met each other.
It's my pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It was nice to meet you last year during Polar Express. Western Maryland.
That was my last big gig. We traveled all over the country. That was my last gig before I got very sick in 2020. And then 2020, I was pretty much laid up the whole year.
Yeah.
Thought I was going to die. You know, not to bring a downer on your show, but I shouldn't be here right now. I'm so blessed and lucky. But the Polar Express tour was so much fun. We traveled all over the country, and I met the nicest people. They were just, everybody was wonderful. Meeting these nice families, you know, grandparents, little kids who know the Polar Express. It was just a joy.
Yep. I tell you, you know, and I think you'd probably agree with me, you know, there are the bigger productions you do, there are the smaller ones, but the ones when you can, you know, when you really get to see the wonder in a little kid's eyes, especially around Christmas or something, that really makes it all worth it, you know? Do you agree?
At Christmas, I'm Jewish, you know, Mike, but I always had a dream I wanted to do a Christmas film, because I grew up loving, you know, White Christmas and all the Christmas films we grew up in when we were kids, and then to do Polar Express, it means so much to me, and also Tom Hanks was my favorite star. Tom Hanks is my favorite movie star. By the way, John Travolta was my second favorite movie star, so I got to work with both of them, so I really lucked out there. Tom couldn't have been nicer on the set. I have so many Tom Hanks stories. He's just a wonderful guy.
Yeah, I've heard that about him because I've interviewed other people that have worked with him, and they say he's just absolutely amazing to work with.
He's a big overgrown kid. He has the kindest heart you could imagine. We come in the first day on Polar Express. I came in there. I didn't know I was working with Tom Hanks. I just knew I was hired in this movie to do Polar Express. Bob Zemeckis, the director. He had directed me in his first film, I Want to Hold Your Hand, back in 1978.
Right.
That was the first film Steven Spielberg ever produced. And I played myself, you know, a Beatles fan. I'm the world's biggest Beatles fan, so I played myself. But then Bob knew me and wrote me into the script.
Wonderful.
You know, so it was great. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome to make that kind of
a
connection.
He's the best director I ever worked with. Better than Spielberg, and I love Steven Spielberg. What can you say? You know, Steven Spielberg is the Babe Ruth of directors. Steven, I don't think his thing is comedy so much. He'll do like these wonderful, marvelous films, you know, Jaws, and most of his films will have these great comic moments, you know, but his greatest films were serious, you know, Schindler's List, Jaws, they're overwhelmingly serious films. Whereas Bob Zemeckis has the instinct for comedy more. That's just more his thing. But I love them both, but of all my directors, Bob Zemeckis is my favorite.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So let me ask you about this here. You know, you left Cumberland. When did you leave Cumberland to head out to Los Angeles?
I left, Mike, the day after high school graduation. I couldn't get out of there quick enough. I was very unhappy in high school. Mm-hmm. And this is how the times was different. This was 1975 I came out. It was June of 75. My dad would send me $400 every month to live on, and you could live on that. My rent, I think, was like $100 a month, if you can believe it, in those days.
Wow.
You know, in L.A., when I left L.A., I think we were paying like $1,700, my roommate and I, we were splitting $1,700 a month. And it was not a great apartment, just a regular apartment.
Sure.
But, you know, it just times change.
Wonderful. And so you went all the way out there. You made up your mind that Cumberland was not the place for you. When you went out there, I mean, did you go out there with the idea of performing? Did you have a previous experience like in theater or anything like that when you were in school here?
Not really. really, Mike. Not really. We had the drama club, but it was all pretty much all girls in those days.
Okay.
So I didn't go into it. I never joined into it. And I did a shtick where I conducted the band. They went to call me on stage. The whole school was at this assembly. Mm-hmm. And they called me up on stage, and I conducted the band. And I did a pratfall. You know, I clicked my heels and did a pratfall. And I brought the house down.
Oh,
that
kind
of got my urge for it. But, I worshiped the comedians. I was very lost in high school. I was very lost. I didn't know any of the subjects. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even find the rooms. I had trouble. I would literally get lost. I was so lost. I mean, literally lost. Where's that room again? And I couldn't do anything. And then I started watching the Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis movies. You know, I always loved the Three Stooges. Curly Howard is my favorite comedian of all time.
Oh, yeah.
I love Daffy Duck. Daffy Duck was an influence on my character. You can kind of see it if you look at my character. Jerry Lewis was a huge influence. I loved the Marx Brothers. I loved Laurel and Hardy. And this was my life.
Mm.
And I came out, I wanted to be a comedian. It was the only thing I really loved doing. So my dad was going to buy me a Dairy Queen. There was a Dairy Queen for sale. And Dad said, I'll buy it. You can run it here in Cumberland. But I didn't want to do that.
Sure.
So he said, okay, I'll finance you while you try to make your way in Hollywood. Dad was a great guy.
It sounds like it. That sounds like, you know, just the opposite of a lot of people, A lot of people, you know, in my family, I wasn't discouraged, but my parents always said, you know, hey, look, you better have a backup plan. And having a backup plan is probably the best bit of showbiz advice I've ever gotten.
Absolutely. You know what I always say, Mike? I get all the time, you know, people will ask, you know, you're in the business. People will say, how do I get in the business? Or they'll be out of high school. How to get in the business. I give them the advice. It was, who was that said this? Oh, it was James Garner. You know, the Rockford Files and all that.
Certainly.
He said when he started the business, his father said, give it 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Start out, give it 5 years, give it everything you've got for 5 years. I'll help you out when I can, but get all the auditions, meet the people you can in 5 years. If you don't make some kind of a mark in 5 years, you probably don't have it.
Right.
And 5 years isn't a huge part of a person's life. You know, you still have pretty much your whole life had up for 5 years.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
not like you've blown anything. So that's what I tell people. I go, give it the 5-year plan.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it in 5 years. See if you can get your break.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty good advice, and that's a pretty reasonable amount of time to be able to do it.
You know the business, you know. If you're going to give it more than 5 years, you know, it just you might not have that thing. Not everybody has it, you know, and you know the business. A part of it is luck. Maybe you'll get a lucky break then, too, but if you don't do anything in 5 years, there's probably not that thing that you need to make it.
Right. I agree. Now, another thing I wanted to ask you, you know, I heard about some of your earlier successes and everything, you know, your steps into it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
When you got out to Los Angeles, what was the first thing you did? Did you start performing right away? Did you study with anybody?
I was doing nothing for the first few months. We just went to the beach for a few months. I came out in June of 75. In January of 76, I started working at the Comedy Store. I did stand-up comedy. I couldn't remember my lines even in those days, Mike. Mm-hmm. My whole routine was on index cards, and I literally went on stage and I read it off index cards. I go, hi, this is Eddie Deason. They'd introduce me. The audience would applaud. I go, sure, but will you respect me in the morning? That was my big opening joke, you know. And it's so far back, I did a Nixon joke, Mike.
Oh.
And, there's a new Nixon stamp they invented, but it didn't work. Everybody spits on the wrong side. That was like a Nixon joke for that time, you know. And it went good the first two times. Then they moved me to the Comedy Store. Mitzi was the owner of the Comedy Store. She was a super nice lady. Mitzi Shore, who was Pauly Shore's mother.
Certainly.
And she moved me to the Comedy Store in Westwood, and I tanked. I did a flop performance, and I realized stand-up wasn't really for me. Some people love stand-up. You know, Robin Williams, these guys, stand-up second nature for them.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Williams, you know, did stand-up the way we walk and breathe, you know, but it just wasn't for me. And the movies were perfect for me because the movies, you don't have to memorize that many lines. You just do your scene. If you screw up, you do take two, you know, you mess up, take two, everybody, okay, get them a coffee. Everybody's friendly on the set, and there's not that pressure, so I like that. Like, people ask me if I did plays. I'm not a good enough actor to do a play. I'm really not. A play, you have to go through this whole script and memorize it, you know, and do it perfectly. I could never do that. Movies were the way for me, and luckily that's what I got into.
I see what you're saying about that, because there is, you know, and especially as you get older, you know, learning lines, especially the way they want things word for word and things like that.
Right.
It gets a little tricky.
Some directors are like that, yeah, and I can never stand that. The best directors give you a little bit of leeway, I think.
Mm-hmm. They do. Yeah. But there are times, too, where if you don't do it word for word, you'll make enemies with the writers, too.
Yes, Yeah, it's subjective, you know. Some writers, too, will be a little lenient, you know. Maybe you said something better than they wrote. Maybe you ad-libbed something. Wait a minute, that's a bit better his way. You know, you don't know. Mm-hmm. But you're right, some are strident, and you've got to do it that way, you know. But I don't like working that way. I like a looser set, you know, where we're all friends, you know, do your best. You do your take, you did it different. Okay, Eddie, you screwed up that line, you know, but let's try to get it like the script. Okay, you know, you know what a good director is. You know this stuff.
I do.
A good director will communicate to you, you know, and do it the way he wants, but he'll do it with kindness, you know, let you work. He's not a mean guy.
Oh, right. I know. Yeah, it's not the person that, you know, the proverbial guy sitting in the big director's chair with the puffy pants and the megaphone.
Exactly, right? The beret.
And the sweater vest. You know, no wonder they were angry.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. So I know that you got out to L.A., you started doing stand-up.
Right.
Now, what was one of your first big things that you got? I think I heard a story about this.
Well, I did the Gong Show. Then okay. I got on the old Gong Show. You know, it was kind of like a Ted Mack amateur hour. I don't know if you remember the Gong Show.
Oh, very well.
You get on it. It was like a vaudeville show.
Yeah.
You put on acts on. If the celebrities, they had three celebrity judges. If they didn't like you, they'd bring a big gong.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I did my routine. I went on and did it, and Paul Williams gonged me. And I think I got a waffle iron out of it. They gave me a waffle iron as my award, and that was my TV debut. Chuck Barris was the host, and he was the nicest guy.
Mm-hmm.
He came over to me, you know, after the show. He said, "You got a really good little act there. Keep working." He gave me, he just talked encouragingly to me. I never forgot what a nice guy Chuck Barris was. I loved him.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my TV debut. And you know, Mike, I've never seen it to this day. For some reason, it was on, and I never got to catch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had friends try to look it up. It was the 131st Gong Show, number 131, and I never got to see it.
Hmm.
And here's another story, Mike. Cut to like 20 or 30 years later, it was like maybe like 10 or 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I'm in an audition. Oh, no, when I was on the Gong Show, I was gong by Paul Williams, you know, the singer Paul Williams.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to this audition. Who's there? Paul Williams. So I go, "Hi, Mr. Williams. Do you remember me?" He looks up. I go, "You gonged me on the Gong Show 20 years ago. It was my TV debut, and you gonged me." So he starts apologizing. "I'm so sorry, Eddie. Please forgive me." You know, he was really impassioned apologizing. I go, "Mr. Williams, don't be silly. It was the Gong Show. It was a lark. Of course I forgive you." Then he explained to me. He said, "I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous now. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have to apologize to anybody we've possibly hurt."
Mm.
He goes, "If I hurt you in any way, I want you to accept my apology." And I said, "Of course I accept. Don't even worry." But he was very sincere about that. He was taking it very seriously.
He's a good guy. He had a podcast out.
Super nice guy.
And I listened to him for a couple of years. And he was just really, really interesting to listen to. It was about gratitude. He would have celebrities on, and it was about gratitude. And, you know, he's, you know, like you had mentioned, he had the issues that you had just mentioned, like with alcohol and things like that.
Right.
And he had people come on and really talk about, you know, gratitude and their success and everything. And it was a really good show. I really liked it. I really liked it.
Sounds good.
Yep. So when you after the Gong Show, and one thing I noticed, and one of the reasons why I asked if you had had, you know, any like really formal training, you were one hell of a physical comedian.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and back in the day, yes, I was.
Yep.
If you look at "I Want to Hold Your Hand" or 1941, that was my shtick. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I got to love that stuff. And that's my favorite thing. I love it. I hate memorizing lines, Mike. I never liked it. The physical shtick always came easy to me, and I love doing it.
Oh,
I
mean,
I appreciate it. That's very kind of you.
Especially in Midnight Madness with some of the stuff
Midnight
that you guys
Madness,
were
yeah,
doing.
Yeah, on the elevator with the dog, yeah.
Yeah, and the, well, when you guys were on your motorcycles or on those little...
Right.
Scooters.
Maggie Rothwell from The Simpsons was I rode on my motorcycle. Yeah, she was a doll.
Right. And you know, the security came over and you ended up upside down. He had you by the leg.
Yeah.
And
that's
you,
right, yeah.
That was hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So Greece, I wanted to ask you about Greece because, I mean, it seems like, I mean, you have just worked with everybody. And
yeah, I've been very blessed. I've been lucky. I've worked with some of the greats.
Right. So one person that you had mentioned was a really good friend to you. I don't know if it started off that way, but it ended up being a really good friend to you was Jeff Conway.
Jeff Conway, yeah. Now, when we were on the set, when we filmed Grease, Jeff was the only cast member I didn't like. I was scared of him. But he was like a tough customer. You know his character, Kinnicky, in the movie?
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of like that in real life. He was like this tough, kind of sluggish guy. So I was kind of scared of him. There was a time... Mike, when we were filming, he tried to get me laid. I've never been with a woman that time. And he literally tried to get a hooker on the set. Literally, I was scared. I was 20 years old. I was green as a lime, you know, and I was really scared. And the hooker never did show up, but he was trying to get me laid and trying to get me a hooker on the set. That was Jeff. Anyway, years later, I think he found religion or whatever, but he was a totally different personality. And we did, I'd say, at least a half a dozen signing shows. It was just Jeff and I together.
Okay.
The only two Grease cast members. And we'd sit and sign. He was like an older brother to me, you know, or a father to me. He'd help me, you know. And the girls would come up and giggle at him. You know, he was committing. Now, at this time, Jeff had 9 back operations. He was in pretty bad shape. He was, like, hunched over. He'd lost a lot of weight. He was kind of, like, pretty worn down by this time. But the girls would come to the show and get us, and they'd be giggling, you know, they were seeing Kinnicky. They were seeing, you know, in the movies, like this Greek Adonis, you know, Jeff Conaway, the way he dances and all, he's like this Adonis, and the girls would giggle over. But he was like, he was kind of like a 90-year-old man at that time.
That's a real shame, because, you know, I had heard that he ended up succumbing, you know, to problems that he had with, you know, painkillers and that sort of thing.
Sad. He was in tremendous pain.
And that's just a whole other problem. That's just a whole other topic of, you know, a problem that we really have in this country with those drugs. You know, it's
totally
just
agree.
It's just a it's an awful, awful thing that's really happened. I mean, on one thing, they do take away the pain, but the consequences that a lot of people experience from that is just really taking its toll on a lot of people. How about Sid Caesar? I mean, what a legend.
Sid Caesar, I was driven home every night in the car with him. We had a chauffeur called Kirk, and he comes over. He goes, "Don't say a word. Don't talk until Mr. Caesar talks to you. Unless he talks, you don't say a word." So I'd sit like a dummy in the back seat. Sid would be in the front seat. And Sid, he was a very intelligent man. He would pontificate in the front seat. He'd go, "The Goths would invade villages." And he knew all this history, you know. The Goths invaded the villages in 1132 AD or whatever. You know,
right.
See all this stuff. And things. He was a very smart guy. And then one day we're riding home and he turns to me. He goes, "So you're the water boy, huh?" I was the water boy. I think the scene was mostly cut out in Greece. But he said that to me. And I said, "Yeah, Mr. Caesar," or something inane, you know. Anyway, the limousine would go up in the winding Hollywood Hills to Sid's mansion, you know. We drop Sid off, say goodbye. Then they go down into Hollywood, my little $100 a month apartment, you know, they drop me off. But the whole time I was with him, he was a very nice man. He didn't talk to me a lot. He would just talk to the chauffeur more, but what can you say? He was a good guy.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He was my dad's hero. My dad thought he was the greatest comedian.
Oh, you know, my father absolutely loved Sid Caesar, still does.
Yeah, kind of our father's generation, Mike, whereas our generation, he doesn't communicate that well to me. He's a nice guy. His comedy doesn't make me laugh that much.
Right.
But my dad just thought he was like Chaplin, you know, he thought he was so good.
Oh, yeah. The one thing that my father and I used to love to watch together, whenever it was on, because sometimes they would show 10 from your show of shows. They would show it on public TV sometimes when they're doing those.
I'd like to see that. I could really see him in his prime. I've just seen little clips of it. I saw the You Bet Your Life clip on the This Is Your Life.
Yes.
I saw that, and that made me laugh. That was funny. But I've seen him in other stuff, and I never thought he had a good face for comedy. He looked like a heavy.
Yeah.
You know, he had this kind of fiendish face, and I always thought he would be a good heavy in a movie.
Right. The bit that you just mentioned was the one I was talking about. Him and Howard Morris.
Yeah, that was hilarious with Howie Morris. Yeah, that was hilarious. I got to be directed by him one day, and he was a very nice guy, Howie Morris. He directed me in a cartoon show.
Oh.
And he couldn't have been nicer, but he's like so funny in that This Is Your Life thing.
You know, he made a lot. He had a lot of work in cartoons doing voice.
Oh, yeah, Ernest T. Bass,
besides, being, behind the scenes writing a lot and showing up, in small bit parts. His bit parts were always memorable, but he did a hell of a lot. I mean, you couldn't shake a dead cat without hitting him in a cartoon, especially through the 70s. Him and Larry Storch.
Punk. When we were kids, there was a cartoon called Punkin' Puss and Mush Mouse, I remember.
Yes.
And Mush Mouse. Yeah, he was Mush Mouse. He was a mouse, yeah.
And then there was the, God, it was put out by the same people that did, like, the Archie cartoons. It was about monsters. The Groovy Ghoulies, I think it was called.
Oh, I remember that. I never saw the show, but I remember it.
Yeah. But he was always...
Ghoulies and Sabrina.
Yes. And Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Right, exactly.
How about... you had mentioned, that you're very fond of John Travolta. What was he like?
Imagine. On the set, he just couldn't have been nice. People don't remember. Well, they do remember. Everybody that lived through it remembers. But at that time after Saturday Night Fever, because he was like James Dean. I mean, he was. There's nobody comparable to how big John Travolta was in the late 70s.
Oh, yeah.
He was this huge star. Then his career went down a little bit, but then he made his comeback with Pulp Fiction. But he was the nice guy in the world. Mike, I was real sick last year. You know, I was in the hospital. I almost died. I was really in bad shape. So anyway, I'm at dinner. This literally happened last week. I'm at dinner. I get a call. I go outside to get the call. Hello? This is John Travolta's secretary, Amanda. John wanted your email. What? You know, you're thinking, are you kidding me? So I gave him my email, and Johnny, I won't tell you what he said, but he just sent me a very sweet note. He sent me a very sweet email, you know. It's personal what he said, but he's just that kind of guy. He was so thoughtful. The fact that John Travolta would send me a note saying this nice stuff to me.
I got to tell you, and I have a story about him, too. I guess about 20 years ago, when I was living down closer to Baltimore, he was filming a scene in a neighborhood I lived in. I don't know if you know the suburb of Essex, Maryland, right outside of Baltimore.
I'm not familiar with it.
They were filming a couple of scenes in a local bar for a movie that he was in called Ladder 49. And
I remember. I've never seen it, but I've heard of it.
Right, right. And one day he decided that he was going to sign autographs. And I think there had to have been a line a mile. I mean, it was go blocks and blocks and blocks away with people wanting to meet him. And I tell you what, they finished filming and it was still daylight out. He was out there for hours and hours. And I tell you what, he shook everybody's hand. He had something nice to say to everybody. He was very gracious when it came to signing things.
Right.
And I tell you what, that man is a gentleman.
Yeah, he totally is. He's a total mensch, yes.
He's a total gentleman, and
I'm proud to have worked with him. I'm proud to know him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could imagine.
He's one of the immortals now. You know, he's one of the Hollywood immortals. He's done three classic films. He had Saturday Night Fever, Grease, and Pulp Fiction.
Right.
He's done a lot of, maybe not that big, but great films. And look at his career. Look how long he's been a star. He's been a star for over 40 years now.
Right.
It's longer than Bogart or, you know, so many of these guys.
Yeah, the only thing that I would say he didn't particularly care for, because apparently he's not proud of Cotter.
No, he was wonderful in that.
Oh, he was good in it, but he just said...
When he left, that guy to replace him was terrible. John was good in the show. Then John left after the third season, and that other guy came in, and the show just died. They jumped the shark.
Yeah, yeah. There are a number of people I'd kind of overheard asking him about Cotter, and he said, I just didn't really care for that. And,
no kid, I didn't know that.
He didn't want to be remembered for it. Interesting.
He was remembered for Saturday Night Fever and Grease, I'm sure, and Pulp Fiction. But that was a part of it. I remember that. I thought he did a great job. I think he's being too hard on himself.
I agree with you. I definitely agree with you. I love that. I thought Cotter was fun. I really enjoyed that show myself.
And Barbarino was a great character. Vinnie Barbarino, he was wonderful.
He sure was. He sure was. How about...
I did a movie, Mike, called Surf 2 years ago. Years later, this was like 1983 with Ron Palillo, who was Horshack.
Right.
And he couldn't have been nicer, just a super nice guy. We became really good friends.
Yeah, he was. I've heard a lot of nice things about him, too. I had a fellow by the name of Tommy McLaughlin on, who directed Friday the 13th Part 6 and had Ron Palillo in it, and said he was just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, he was great.
Absolutely wonderful. So I'm kind of skipping around a little bit here.
Sure.
I noticed that you had worked on several occasions with Tim Conway in a couple of the Dorf videos.
Yeah, nice guy you could imagine. I did a movie in a bit. It was called The Long Shot. And Tim wrote me in for a scene. It's not even that funny, but he wrote me in a scene. You know, Tim Conway, one of my childhood idols. I grew up worshiping McHale's Navy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I never got into Carol Burnett that much for whatever reason, but I loved him in McHale's Navy, and he was my hero. And to meet him, he's just the nicest guy you could ever imagine. And we did that, and then I did three of the Dorf things, you know, where he played Dorf Goes Golfing or Dorf Goes to the Horse Races. He was a big horse player. He would go to Hollywood Park all the time. He loved the ponies, but he was just a super nice guy.
I had heard that about him, he was just a delight to work with, and especially when he and Harvey, I know you said you didn't really watch Carol Burnett that much, but I tell you, some of the most classic television moments had to have been with him and Harvey Korman on the Carol Burnett show.
And breaking up Harvey Korman, it was funny in itself outside of the sketch. Yeah, they were a great team.
They sure were. I see that you worked with Weird Al.
Yes, I was the man in the wall. I didn't memorize lines. I've always had a hard time memorizing lines, so I didn't really want to do it. But he wrote so I could be the man in the wall, so I wasn't shown. I was like a talking wall, and I could read my dialogue there. This is how it started, Mike. I did a movie called War Games in 1983, which is one of my better films, and I had a scene in there. And they're filming it, and I kept screwing up my dialogue over and over. I had to say the words data encryption algorithm. And they go, okay, action. I go, da da da. And the data endocrine algorithm, cut. Okay, and the data algorithm, I'm going to my cut. And the data endocrine algorithm, cut. So the director calls me over. He bends, you know, he beckons me over with crooking his finger, literally. Come here, Eddie, let's go for a walk. So he puts his arm around my shoulder. He goes, look, you're costing the studio a lot of money. What we're going to do is we're going to write your whole roll down on these things. They're called idiot cards. And he looked at me when he said idiots. He goes, idiot cards. He was a little exasperated, you know. And by the way, this was my director, Marty Breth, who was later fired from the film. But he did my scene. Anyway, I did the scene in the cue cards. I go, da-da-da, the data encryption algorithm. The cue cards was easy. We did it in like one take, you know. Matthew Broderick, it was like Matthew Broderick's second film. I would drive to the set with Matthew. He was the nicest guy in the world. But we did the scene. We finished it up. And anyway, my director, Marty Breth, got fired. They didn't like his rushes. Now, John Badham was brought in to take over. Luckily, John Badham saw the rushes on my scene, and it's the only scene he kept in of Marty Breth. He said, well, let's keep the one scene, but everything else was scrapped. And then John Badham directed the rest of the film. But I was directed by Marty Breth, who later did Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He was a very wonderful director. I loved him. But for that reason, for that movie, I guess it just wasn't right for him.
Sure. And that happens, too. You hear about somebody
Sometimes the mismatch, yeah. It's like Eric Stoltz. He was the original guy in Mask. It was some other guy. I forget. Eric Stoltz was the first guy in Back to the Future.
Yes.
And he played Marty McFly, but he just wasn't. Eric's a wonderful actor. He's a good friend of mine. He's a wonderful guy. But he just wasn't right for that role. And they had to let him go. Bob Zemeckis said it was the hardest thing he ever did. He had to fire him. And then, of course, they hired Michael J. Fox, and it's a legendary film.
Yes. I'd read about that a number of times. And and again, too, you know, that really wasn't a reflection on Eric Stoltz, because he's just...
No, he just, you know, sometimes they're just wrong for the role, you know?
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right about that. I wanted to ask a bit about 1941. Now, of course, you got to work with Steven Spielberg. And what was that like?
Marvelous director, you think? You know, it's like, what can you say? It's like saying Babe Ruth was a great baseball player or something.
Oh, yeah.
Of course he was. My big moment on that, on the set, I'm there on the set one day, Mike, and Steven Spielberg, he goes, Eddie, you want to have lunch with us? So I'm there, oh, sure, you know, that I'm like this goofy kid. I was like 22. We go into the commissary of the studio. It's me, John Belushi, Steven Spielberg, and Dan Aykroyd. The four of us are having lunch. Mike, I didn't say a word. I was in such a daze, you know. It was so surreal to me. I sat there like an idiot while these three talked about the business, and, you know, they swapped stories and all. And I'm sitting there, you know, I'm like Ralph Cramden, humming. I couldn't believe I was there. Anyway, we finished lunch. We were there like an hour. I don't think I said one word. And I realized I didn't have any money. Oh, my God. But luckily, Spielberg picked up the tab.
Oh.
He picked up our tab. He said, this is on me. So I didn't get made a fool of. And John Belushi, by the way, was the greatest guy in the world. He was so kind to me always. He was like the greatest guy ever. Yeah, really, really nice guy. And so was Dan Aykroyd, super nice guy.
I had heard that about them. And I had heard that, you know, and John Belushi.
John, you kind of hear ambivalence of John. You kind of hear he was this wild man, you know, causing trouble all year. If you read Wired, you know, there's a lot of gnarly stories about it. But to me, he was always just this gentle, nice man. I met him at the premiere of I Want to Hold Your Hand. He was there, and we sat on the couch and talked together. And he was just, he couldn't have been nicer. He was just a great guy.
Right. So I wanted to ask you a little bit, too. You had the scenes up on the Ferris wheel, which I loved.
Yes.
You worked with Murray Hamilton. And
yes.
Tell me a little bit about filming with him.
Murray was the greatest guy. He was a great comedy partner. I loved every minute to work with him. He couldn't breathe up there. He was a chronic smoker. He was like a three-pack-a-day smoker or whatever. And Steven literally had an oxygen tank down there. And we would film a while on Ferris wheel, and Murray could not breathe. And Steven would say, bring him down. We go down, and he would take some hits of oxygen. He could breathe again. Then we go back up in the Ferris wheel. My great story in that, Mike, is Steven was whipping us around one scene. Those Ferris wheels being whipped around real quick. I had bad motion sickness, and I got nauseous.
Right.
He said, please take me down. I could not. I was up and get sick, you know. So Steven took me down. He goes, lay down in my dressing room. Hmm. So Steven Spielberg's secretary took me down, and I laid in his cot, literally. Mm-hmm. So I'm crawling on the floor. I got in the cot. I started to lose. I got up down on my knees, and I went in, and I threw up in his bathroom. And I remember, my God, I just threw up in Steven Spielberg's toilet. It's one of the highlights of my career. It was an honor.
You know, that about says it all right there, I think.
Yeah.
There's really nothing you can add to that story to make it any greater than it is. That's
it was great. A proud moment.
That's great. How about, you had mentioned, you know, one of my favorites of all time, one of my favorite people ever, was John Candy. And I know that you, don't think you had scenes with him, but I know that you were...
No.
You did get to meet him and know him a little bit. Tell me what he was like.
Once I was walking on Hollywood Boulevard, I didn't know him that much. Literally, I didn't know because I'd never seen at that point in time Second City. I'd never seen on TV. Mm-hmm. And this was early in John's career. 1941 is when it was really early film. He mm-hmm. wasn't, you know, Uncle Buck or all these wonderful films he was to later do, you know. Mm-hmm. So one day I'm on Hollywood Boulevard, the corner of Hollywood and Vine, literally. You know, the classic, this is Hollywood and Vine. Mm-hmm. They had Howard Johnson's there. So who comes walking down one day? John Candy and his manager. This is after we wrapped on 1941. Mm-hmm. They said, Eddie, you want to get some ice cream with us? So we all went into Howard Johnson's together. We talked, you know, and he was just this gentle, wonderful man. And the manager was a little bit more dicey. I was talking and he said, you really talk like that in real life? He was kind of laughing at me. I have like this kind of nasally voice. He was kind of laughing at me. Mm-hmm. And I remember what a gentleman John was. He didn't laugh along and he was just there, you know, he was just totally polite. Mm-hmm. And we just talked, that was just a special moment for me to have that ice cream with him that one day. Mm-hmm. That was the closest I got to him. We didn't talk that much on the set, because that was my one big moment with him, but I saw how loved he was on the set. Mm-hmm. Everybody just loved this guy. He was so wonderful. Yeah.
That's very true about him. And the thing is that I'd heard about him too, was that he was very good at, very kind at standing up for people. When it came,
that sounds like him. So John,
I'd interviewed Larry Hankin a number of months back on my show.
Yes, I know Larry. Yeah.
And, apparently, you know, he was doing a couple of things, or apparently he and the director of, I think it was Armed and Dangerous, just weren't seeing eye to eye on mm-hmm. anything. There were a couple of scenes where they would improv, and, you know, hey, you're not going to find better improv than Larry Hankin. You know, you'll be kind of mm-hmm. hard-pressed. And mm-hmm. apparently, you know, he was really giving him a hard time, and John, you know, really stood up for him and, you know, kind of got the director to back off of him a bit. And
interesting. That's a nice story.
Yeah, yeah. And Larry, I mean, gosh, you know, he's just another treasure, you know. Mm-hmm. of show business, you know, just so many great stories, and he's been around so much and everything, you know, as have you, really, as have you.
Well, thank you.
You know, I gotta say, you know, another one that I really liked growing up, you know, that I would watch, you know, quite a bit whenever it was on was, Midnight Madness. And that's a movie that my brother and I still quote to each other to this day.
It's a very funny movie. It's excuse me. Mm-hmm. It was Michael J. Fox's first film. Mm-hmm. Michael and I used to play handball together. I had a Super Bowl, and we would go to the wall at Disney Studios. We'd play handball together. He was a big Twilight Zone fan.
Oh.
Twilight Zone is my all-time favorite show.
Me too.
So we would talk and compare our favorite. Yeah, I love the Twilight Zone. You learn so much about life from that show.
But
anyway, we talked about the Twilight Zone. Michael was the nicest guy. He was this little kid. It was his first film. Nobody knew who he was. Mm-hmm. So anyway, cut to about 7 years later. I'm on the lot. You know, I think it was Universal. I'm on the lot. This red sports car comes zooming up. It screeches in front of me. It's Michael J. Fox. You know, it's after I Back to the Future. He's the biggest star in the world then. Hi, Eddie. How are mm-hmm. you? He hadn't changed one bit. He was this huge star. You're working? He talked a little bit. We chatted, and he was just a wonderful guy. He hadn't changed from that little kid I knew in Midnight Madness. Just a sweet guy. Mm-hmm. And then he zoomed off in his car, I remember. That was the last time I saw him. God bless him.
Wow. Another one that was in that, and I mean, this was in a lot of ways kind of a lot of like really well-known character actors were in this one because
absolutely Pee-wee Herman. This was pre Pee-wee Herman, Paul Rubens. He wasn't Pee-wee yet.
Right.
Like when we got to be friends on the set, that's where we're friends to this day. I haven't seen him in a while, but I can't tell you what a nice guy he is. I remember seeing around time. There's a deli in LA called Canner's. It's like a big showbiz hangout.
I've heard of it.
And
yeah.
I was there one day and he was there after midnight mass. I go, "Hey Paul, how are you? Da-da-da. What's new?" He said, "I'm pushing the script around town, but nobody wants, this was Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Cause I'm pushing the script around town." And he looked frustrated. Because nobody wants it, nobody's trying to buy it, you know. I said, "Well, write me a part in there or something." He was gracious. He never did. I would have been proud to be in that movie. But I think his parents helped finance that film.
Yeah.
I think his parents put up some of the money, and it, of course, became a big hit, and he became a legend, a comedy legend.
He is. He really is. And even some of the things that he did before that, I had seen him in, like, a number of Cheech and Chong movies over
Cheech
the years.
Cheech and Chong films, yes, yeah.
Where... the characters that he was playing in them, you know, I could see where Pee-wee was starting to evolve with some
absolutely.
Of his mannerisms and some of the things that he had been, you know, kind of doing and just, you know, kind of the, you know, the silly way he would play some of those characters. And, you know, he's just amazing. You know, that if you really think about, you know, that, you know, Pee-wee Herman was really a contribution to pop culture and showbiz.
Oh, absolutely. Unequivocally. He's one of the greats.
Mm-hmm. He absolutely is. He absolutely is. I remember seeing John Fiedler in that movie from the Bob Newhart show.
Yes. Nice guy. Yeah.
Yep. And Irene Tedrow, I mean, God, what was she not in?
Yeah, from Dennis the Menace when we were kids, yeah.
And a lot of other things, too. I remember her when making cameos on Three's Company, and she was kind of doing a lot of smaller bits as she got older and everything.
Right.
And did you get to know the twins, the two twins that were...
Yes, yeah, Peggy and Lulu. The Thompson twins is a group. I could have sworn they were the Thompson twins. They were what? I remember their first names were Peggy and Lulu, but I forget their last name. But we called them the twins.
Yeah,
they were giggly, just like in the movie on the set. They would be giggly, and they were both very sweet.
Yeah.
Hopefully, they're doing well now.
Was that actually their giggle, or was that something recorded?
No, that was them. That was their giggle. Yeah,
it just reminded me. It almost reminded me of I don't know. I couldn't, like, dolphins or something, that, you know, that little giggle
right,
they had.
I can see that.
How about Marvin Kaplan was another one that we saw towards the end, the hotel manager.
Yes, wonderful guy. Super nice guy. Top Cat. Yeah, I remember his voice on Top Cat when we were kids.
Oh, certainly. It's Top Cat, and then from Alice.
Yeah.
And, you know, just so many other things. Oh, A Mad, 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 Mad World. Which,
what did he play in that? I don't remember him from that. I love that movie. I guess there were so many stars in that, it's hard to remember them all.
Yeah, he was in the part where...
Yeah, he was at the gas station, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was him and Arnold Stang.
Yeah, he was hilarious. You're right. He was wonderful at the gas station with Jonathan Winters on the bicycle, right?
Yeah, Jonathan Winters was, you know, tearing the place up, and him and Arnold Stang were trying to stop him.
Hilarious. That film's hilarious from beginning to end. It's one of my favorites.
I love it, too. I love it, too. And that's another one. Well, it was actually kind of similar in a way to Midnight Madness.
Midnight Madness was based on that. Midnight Madness was definitely a remake of it. Now, of course, it wasn't near as good, and we didn't have the big star names, but it was definitely like Midnight Madness. Yeah, that was very deliberate.
Right. How about Stephen First? What was he like?
Stephen First was the nicest guy ever. He was a pizza delivery boy, you know. That's how he got his start. But I'd see him on the set, and he was always a great guy, yeah. The last days, we worked together. We were Facebook friends towards the end. Mm-hmm. But we were at the same voiceover agency, and he had slimmed down. You know, you think of Stephen First, he was kind of like this fat, roly-poly guy.
Yeah.
But he was like a thin, svelte guy. And I'm there at the voiceover. He goes, "Hi, Eddie." Hi. I bet you can't guess who I am. I looked at him, I didn't recognize him. He goes, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you $10 if you can tell me who I am." So I'm really looking at my quick thought. He goes, "I'm Stephen First." I didn't recognize my friend. Uh-huh. He just slimmed down so much. And then, of course, he didn't have to pay me, but I recognized him. We talked, he was great. And then we got to be Facebook friends. And then he died so young, you know. He's such a nice guy, but he died so young. I was very sad when he died.
He was a young man. He was only in his early 60s,
young man. I don't know what he died, because he wasn't fat anymore.
No.
I don't know what it was.
Yeah, I know. It just seems like it can be just anything. You know, I mean, and especially, I think it was like either 2016 or 2017 that he passed away. And I think during those 2 years, I think we lost half of Hollywood.
Is that right?
you know, if you remember, it seemed like every week somebody else was going, you know, and it was rock and roll people too. And
no kid.
Yeah, it was just one of the, you know, just that year I was just like, oh my God, I didn't even want to look at the news because somebody else I liked was going, you know?
I remember the big one was 1977. I remember we lost Groucho, Elvis, mm-hmm. Bing Crosby, and Charlie Chaplin. That was like four of these, you know, showbiz legends of all time. You know, as big as you can get.
That was big.
You know, this one, I don't know if you know this story, Mike. Mm-hmm. The last day of shooting on Grease, the very last scene was the film where, you know, Olivia's in the room with the pink ladies. You know, look at me, I'm Sandra Dee. You know, she's saying, mm-hmm. Stocker Channing, you know.
Right.
That was the last scene shot in Grease. They mm-hmm. shot that scene on August 16th, 1977. That was the same day Elvis died.
Oh.
Now, look at that scene. There's a they sing to Elvis. Elvis, Elvis, get your filthy paws, you know. Elvis, mm-hmm. don't shake your pelvis at me, whatever Stockard sings, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he's singing to Elvis Presley. That same day Elvis died. It's just too bizarre. It's like the Twilight Zone of a coincidence.
Yeah.
That exactly happened.
You know something? I think I remember. I mean, I remember the day Elvis died and everything. And
yeah, me too.
Isn't it
down rain in L.A.? It just poured out. It wasn't raining the rest of the week, mm-hmm. but it poured. It was like some kind of godlike thing. And Elvis was like a god. He absolutely was. He's the legend of legends.
He sure was.
You want to hear a cool Christmas present, Mike? On Facebook, mm-hmm. this couple. They said for a Christmas present, this was maybe like 3 years ago, they said, we're going to take you to Graceland. They take me to Graceland for the weekend. They paid all my expenses. They couldn't have been nice. But is that a cool Christmas present? So I got to go to Graceland and see, you know, Elvis's home. It was just what a joyous time.
That's got to be a great trip. I've got to make that trip one of these days.
Oh, so great. Oh, I loved it.
I've got this bucket list of trips I want to take and things I want to see and everything. It just seems...
You're an Elvis fan. Are you an Elvis fan?
Sure.
Yeah, you have to see it. It's just, you'll see the pink Cadillac. They had his TV, just to shoot, you know, Elvis would shoot the TV with a gun if he didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Goulet came on, they had one of the TVs he shot out. It's just really fun. What got me is it's kind of smaller than you think. When you go inside, it's mm-hmm. rather small. The rooms are rather small. You know, it's not like this giant palace.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it was a pretty big place, but you'll be surprised how little it looks when you get inside.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, you'll have fun, I guarantee it.
And the thing is, being a music guy, I mean, that's primarily what I did before I got into acting. I was a musician for all those years. You would think I would have been there by now, but, you know, so I know that you're a big music lover and you happen to be fond of the Beatles, and I know I could probably have you on.
When I did, I Want to Hold Your Hand, I played a Beatles nut. I was playing myself.
Uh-huh.
That was the closest I've ever come to being myself in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I play a Beatles fanatic, and that's what I am.
Right. Now, tell me about this, because I wanted to kind of elaborate on this a bit here. I know that you really love them. Were you one of the ones that watched them on Ed Sullivan the first time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I remember them coming to America. We all sat around in the living room and watched them on the Ed Sullivan show.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, get this cut. It was 1984.
Uh-huh.
It was the Tonight Show. Paul McCartney was the guest with Johnny Carson. My friend got me tickets to that show.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing a terrible TV show called Punky Brewster at the time.
Yeah.
The guy on the show, George Gaines. Yeah, George Gaines got me a ticket.
Huh.
So I went with a friend and we're sitting, Paul McCartney's interviewed. Anyway, the interview ended and Paul's coming out. Hundreds of us ran out. There was like a scene from A Hard Day's Night. We all ran out. Paul comes out in his sports car.
Mm-hmm.
Being a nice guy, he stopped his car. He rolled down the window.
Uh-huh.
And Mike, I got to reach in and I touched him. I touched the Beatle. I touched Paul McCartney on the arm. I got uh-huh. to touch him. And then he sped off. And I swear to God, his car ran over my foot. He sped off and I felt this crunching on my foot like an elephant. It was like, it was so powerful. It like smashed my foot. And I think he drove his car over my foot. I'm never sure. It might have been somebody just stepping on me. But I can't imagine a human being stepping that hard. It just really smashed me, and I think he drove his car over my foot.
Wow. Yeah. Did you ever get to meet and talk at length to any of the Beatles?
No, never on that. That was when I saw Paul, and I've seen Paul and Ringo both in concert.
Okay.
And then Paul once did an impression of me. Paul was being interviewed once for a Beatles magazine. My old friend Joe Pope, sadly he died of AIDS, but
mm-hmm.
he told me, he was interviewing Paul McCartney, and he said, did you ever see a film called I Want to Hold Your Hand? And Paul did me. He goes, and the answer come back. In that movie, I do a scene where I go, and the answer come back. Ask me who's the youngest Beatle. And the answer come back, George. Ask me who's the oldest Beatle. And the answer come back. And Paul did an imitation of me. He said, so I've always been flattered by that. Anyway, I was playing Santa Claus once. It was my dream to play Santa Claus once. In 1987, I was at a shopping mall,
mm-hmm.
and it was Christmas time. It was December 22nd, 1987. The Santa Claus didn't show up. So they literally, the manager of the mall comes over. He goes, "Any of you guys want to play Santa Claus?" And I jumped through my skin and go, "I'd love to do that." So I went in and I played Santa Claus and I talked to all the little kids. You know, it was my dream of dream. It was the happiest Christmas I ever had. Mm. Anyway, I'm on my break. So, you know, you beat Santa Claus and they give you a 15-minute break and you get to take off. It was a very hot suit, the Santa suit. So I take it off. I look over in the bookstore. Who's coming out? George Harrison. George Harrison has a bodyguard on each side of him. He's coming out. He's had a little book he bought. And nobody recognized him. I was like the only one, but nobody was bothering him. George Harrison's walking through this crowded mall and nobody's bugging him.
Huh.
He walked all the way down the corridor. I got to the side of him, and I was, like, hopping on the side. Like an idiot, I hopped all the way down. George is there, and I'm parallel to him. I was about 10 feet away. And I to this day, I regret that I didn't approach and say, "Hi, George." But you picked up that he wanted to be left alone. He wanted his privacy.
Sure.
So I kind of didn't bother him. And, of course, I was a little scared to say, "Hi, George." Da-da-da-da. He might have been a nice guy. I don't know. But I followed him out, and then he walked out the door. But that's how I saw George. Mm-hmm. And Ringo, I've never actually made contact with. I just seen him in concert. I've seen him in concert twice.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Never met John. John was my favorite Beatle, and I never had the pleasure of meeting him.
Mm-hmm. That was another one of those things, too. Just like when Elvis died, you know, a couple years later, you know, we lost, you know, John Lennon.
And
I was in about seventh grade at the time, and that was like another one of those big, like, milestone events that you always remember where you were and what you were doing when you heard it.
Yes, I was on. In fact, my Uncle Leo, I'm hanging out with him today. It's funny you say that. We were just talking about that today. We were on a double date. I was with my, this lady, I was to later marry her. She wasn't my wife then, but she was kind of my girlfriend, and we went out on a double date with her. It was me and Linda, and Carl went out with somebody else. And then we're at dinner, you know, this nice Hollywood restaurant, and then, you know, you hear John Lennon died. You couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And I remember we went to a movie that night, but we were in shock.
Yeah, I remember they announced it on Monday Night Football. Howard Cosell announced it.
I didn't get to see that, but I've seen the clip. It's incredible.
It is. It is. And he was broken up because apparently he knew them, too. I guess, you know, from, all of his years in journalism and, you know, the circles.
Yeah, and I think he interviewed John.
Yeah. That's just, that was just another one of those days, you know, where, wow, you just can't believe it. And you're just completely.
Yeah, it was surreal. Yeah. What a tragic loss. Could you imagine John on Facebook or Twitter now? You know, he'd be so wonderful in that.
You know their history a lot. And I think I'd seen you state that you had read close to 600 or 700 actual books on the Beatles.
Absolutely. Mike, I've got four in my room right now. I'm reading Woody Allen's autobiography now. I finished Cary Grant's, which I loved. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend that if you're into Cary Grant. I worship Cary Grant.
Yeah.
And now I'm reading Woody Allen's, and I have four Beatles books. I'm waiting. I think it's a John book. I have two George books and a Beatles book there. So I'm looking forward to reading them. I never get tired of reading about them. There's always new great stories about them.
Interesting. Interesting. I was just watching North by Northwest the other day, as a matter of fact.
Turner Classic. Yeah, that's one of his best. I love that movie.
I really like that movie. But what I wanted to ask you, I'm sure in 76, I had heard there was rumors of them getting back together, or somebody was trying to. Maybe it was Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, wasn't it? There were all kinds of rumors they'd get back together. And it never quite happened.
Okay.
It'd always be like three would agree to it, but the fourth one wouldn't. And then George would want to do it, or George wouldn't want to do it. And I know Ringo didn't want to do it. And it just never happened. The four of them can't get it, which is kind of good. I think it probably would have been a little anticlimactic. You know, they can never live up to the Beatles myth, you know, no matter how good they were.
Right.
It would have been interesting, but it's kind of good in retrospect that they didn't get back together, I think.
Yeah. Well, Eddie, it's been wonderful to talk to you tonight. I really appreciate you.
It's been my pleasure. It's been joyous. Yeah.
Being willing to spend the time with us and everything. Stick around a couple of minutes.
I heard what a great interview you are, what a great show you have. It's definitely true. You're a wonderful interviewer, and continued success with your show. Well, I hope you can, by the way, get this to me on Facebook. I want to put a post on my Facebook page so my Facebook friends can listen to this interview.
Oh, you better believe it. I sure will, Eddie. I sure will.
Yeah, coordinate that with Steve, my manager, please.
Yep, I'll definitely get that out to you and everything. I'm most definitely here. Well, like I said, you know, I'm really glad that you're back to your old self. You know, I've been watching what Uncle Leo had been putting out on Facebook just to kind of let us know. Kind of like Ferris Bueller, you know, we were getting ready to put up a water tower that said "Save Eddie" on it, because I think one of the reasons why we all get into entertainment, you know, of course we like to express ourselves, we like to make things, but we like to make people smile. And one thing I'd really like to say to you, and I really mean that, having got, you know, getting to know you a little bit over the last couple of years, you know, you you know, as you said, Chuck Barris was very encouraging to you on the Gong Show. When I made my debut on Gotham, you were very encouraging to me. You wrote me a really nice note on Facebook, you know, just kind of preparing me for it, you know, telling me to go in and go for it. And I'll never forget that. And
I'm very happy to say that makes my day. I'm glad.
And, you know, just about every day, you know, you're sharing a story and you're saying something kind to people, because I think, you know, just like everybody else that entertains and everything, you like to see a smile on people's face, and that's something that you do very well. And I'd like to thank you for that.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for that. So,
pleasure. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you, Mike.
Sure. So, folks, we've got Eddie Deason with us this evening here. If you like, you know, he's all over Amazon Prime. If you go in and you search Eddie Deason, about a gazillion of his movies are going to pop up. Be sure you watch him because he's wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to promote, or while we're at it, Eddie?
I'm trying to think. Not really. We're trying to get back into science. You know, with the virus, it's changed all of our lives so much. But we're trying to get Grease, you know, my Grease pals, Barry Pearl, and again. By the way, have you had Barry Pearl on your show?
I've not yet. I'm hoping to. I'd love to.
He would be wonderful. He's the nicest guy in the world. Talk to Steve about getting him on, because you'll love Barry. He's a raconteur. He'll tell you some great stories, and he's a consummate pro. Barry, I call my older brother. He's been my older brother for 45 years. So I just think he'd be a great guest on your show. So please try to get him. He'll get along great with you.
Well, I sure will. I'll definitely look into that, Eddie. Well,
yeah, as far as promoting, just hopefully I'll get some signing shows in the future. Yeah, hopefully, you know, the virus will clear up, we can start doing them again.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, yeah. Eddie, well, thank you for being with us tonight, folks. This is Eddie Deason on Foul Players Radio, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Howdy, it's Matt Gwynn here, popping in to let you know about the adventures of the albino rhino. It's a show Frank the Giraffe here, my co-host James Godwin, and myself put on for you guys twice a week. Every Wednesday, we talk to a comedian, and every Friday, we call it Freak Yeah Friday. The show itself is not safe for work, and that freak is definitely a different word. I just don't know what podcast you're going to be listening to this promo on. And I don't want to, you know, start screaming explicatives while you're sitting in your office, if you're lucky enough to have been able to go back to the work that you did before inside of an office or whatever, you know. But we go on an adventure twice a week, and it's a good time because we get to sit down and talk to some really cool people. And I enjoy it because, you know, I'm just curious little albino who likes to get to know folks, you know? You can find us a couple ways. Actually, multiple ways, really. Man, there's a lot of different ways to find us. You can find us through our central hub, which is www.albinorhino.me. It's the website. Find me on. And then, you know, the podcast, you can find the videos on YouTube. Search for Adventures of the Albino Rhino. Also linkable from our website. And you can also find us through Anchor, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Radio Public, and Spotify. That's right. We're on the same place Joe Rogan is. Granted, we're not the Joe Rogan Experience, but you know what I mean? We're there. So give us a listen. Promise you won't be dissatisfied. And enjoy your day.
What's going on, minions? Mike here for Misery Point Radio, and you're listening to the Coast to Coast Power Hour on the SJ Network. Now, I know what you're thinking. Mike, what the F is a Coast to Coast Power Hour? Well, my uneducated and uninformed friend, the Coast to Coast Power Hour is a Borg-like collective of epic podcasters from epic podcasts that have all come together to discuss the important things in life. Pop culture, current events, random awesomeness, stuff like that. Trust me, you need this in your life. For more information on this show and all the shows on the Coast to Coast Power Hour, as well as on the SJ Network, reach out to publicist Steve Joyner at www.s-j-network.com or stevesjnetwork@gmail.com. No need to thank me. I'm just out here, you know, changing lives.
What's Your Effin' Binge is a podcast brought to you by Chris, Anchor, and Spotify. And what we talk to our guest about is what they're currently binge-watching on TV. And what we do is we like to take a different approach. I don't want to know what the name of the show is that they're going to talk about before they come on. I have to actually guess it. So I ask them who, what, when, where, why, and try to figure out what it is that they're watching. A lot of times I'm able to guess it, and sometimes I'm not. And that's fine. That adds to the comedy of the show. We like to bring our guest on, whether they're a model or an actress or producer or musician, and just let them have a platform to be able to tell everybody what they have coming up next, and also entertain everybody with what's worth watching. So I hope everybody tunes in for the next episode of What's Your Effin' Binge. Thanks. It's Chris.